From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made in Rochester this afternoon when tenants from the Meigs and Monroe Tenant Union will deliver a letter to their landlord. The tenants say the landlord has ordered them to leave their apartments by the end of the month. They call it a gentrification plan for the neighborhood. The term gentrification is sometimes misunderstood, so if you're unsure what it means, you're not alone. An upcoming conference aims to help people in our area not only better understand what gentrification is, but also its history in the Rochester area and its ties to segregation. It will include the voices of people who have been directly affected by gentrification, people who have been forced out of their neighborhoods to make way for development, or sometimes when outside pressures bring land or home values up past the point where people living in it, even those who own their own homes, can even afford the taxes. So there's a lot to talk about here, and we're going to preview that conference this hour. We'll discuss how members of our community are trying to deal with the issue of gentrification. And one of the people behind the conference is, of course, Calvin Eaton, founder and executive director of 540 West Main Community Learning Academy, who is back here in studio. And as we go throughout the hour, we're going to be joined by other members from the community, some who are working on this conference and some who have their own stories to share about gentrification. But Calvin, welcome back to you. Nice to have you as always.
Thank you, Evan. I'm glad to be here.
This is a conference that's coming up on October 20th, but it's sort of a sequel to something that happened earlier this year. Tell us a little bit about
that.
Yeah,
so this is the fall edition of the Gentrification Conference, and we the inaugural event happened in March of this year. So we had such great success. We were at 441 Ministries for the initial conference that the community's response was overwhelming, that they wanted more. They wanted a longer day, more opportunities for small group breakout and discussion. So Shane Wiegand and I of City Roots Community Land Trust said, let's do it. Let's put it together again for the fall. So now it'll be an annual spring and fall edition.
Gentrification is a word that comes up in a way that, first of all, frankly, I probably as a journalist used that term in many news stories over the years without fully getting my head around it. I think some people have a vague idea of what it means.
Right.
But let's start by asking the question of what it means to you when you hear that word.
Well, I'll share the kind of the textbook definition for the community listening, kind of theoretically or from the perspective of academia. Gentrification is the systemic buying of deteriorated or dilapidated housing, usually by upper middle class or developers, and the term always is associated with individuals who are of lower class being pushed out of that area. So for me, just in learning and educating and really that being the focus of the work that I do, it's all about looking at the institutions, the systems, and urban planning, how cities are developed and the why and all of that. So usually when people see like a Starbucks coming into a neighborhood or the term, you know, yuppies or hipster, those are terms associated with gentrification. But really, these are it's a much larger concept historically and institutionally, for sure.
Okay. And so I have some kind of questions about how it usually unfolds.
Yeah.
But before we get there, the Gentrification Conference that is coming up this month is Saturday, October 20th. So it's 2 weeks from Saturday.
Yes.
October 20th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Ryan Community Center with the theme of Who Are the Gentrified? Who is this conference for and what are you really targeting here?
Well, for this edition, Shane and I, we really wanted to share the stories, the real life stories of individuals who have been affected by gentrification in negative ways. We read, when you read stories and you see the statistics and you see the development going on even in Rochester downtown, it's often hard to put a face to who are these things impacting the city of Rochester and all of the development that has gone on. Oftentimes we see one side of that and individuals don't see the ramifications of what happens when you close the Cadillac Hotel, for instance, mm-hmm. and displace many individuals who lived there for many years and paid rent. What happens to those people? Where did they go? were they given adequate housing or an adequate replacement, or did they even want to be put out of their property, for lack of a better word? So the fall, we're really focusing on having community members tell their stories so that it really helps make a more emotional connection with these larger concepts that you don't always see what they mean with your eyes.
All right, so if you want to register, if you want to get involved with the conference on Saturday, October 20th, the website is 540gentrificationrock.com.
Yes, .org.
Oh, my boy.
.com.
My sign.
Typo.org.
A typo on your flyer, I just want to tell you. This one wasn't the host. It's usually the host's fault. It's .org.
Yes.
All right, so it's 540gentrificationrock, ROC.org, if you're interested in finding out what it's all about, if you want to get involved, if you want to be there on Saturday, October 20th. And now let me go ahead and welcome our other guests who are joining us in studio. And hello to everyone who have just joined us here. Ryan Acuff is a member of the Board of Directors for City Roots Community Land Trust. And welcome back to the program, Ryan. Nice to see you as always.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Muhammad Ghazali. And I hope, Muhammad, did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay. And Muhammad Ghazali is a member of the Board of Directors for City Roots Community Land Trust. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And also with us is Jody Francis.
Yes, sir. Jody
Francis is a member of the Rochester Tenant Union. Jody, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And so, Calvin, now that we've got a full studio here and we've kind of set the table for how we sort of at least broadly define gentrification,
right.
I think it's a chance to understand how it impacts, and this is a news term, real people. Sometimes
right.
we talk about it, you know, sort of broadly.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about why you wanted friends of yours like Muhammad, for example,
right, yeah.
to be here.
Well, it's really important that people understand that, you know, really what 540 looks at with gentrification and even, and Ryan can speak more to the Community Land Trust, is revitalization is great as a concept. We want communities to be vibrant. We want them to be safe. We want them to look beautiful. But we don't want to do that at the expense of those who maybe have less income or are not middle class, or we don't want to be displacing people, or even looking at it when you revitalize a neighborhood, who's making those decisions? Who decides what gets put on the corner? Who decides what developments are going in? Is it some people coming in who have money or power or prestige? Or is it a conversation with the community that has existed there for many decades? And oftentimes, with the concept of gentrification, you find that the individuals who have lived in a neighborhood like the Susan B. District or like Parcells Avenue in Beechwood, things happen and those individuals don't have a say to say, you know, what would I like to see on my corner, or how would I like to see my street redesigned? Those individuals are deliberately not put or not welcome to the table.
Okay. Muhammad, do you want to tell a little bit of your own story about how you view gentrification and how, you know, you've sort of seen it play out?
Yeah. You know, this is very, you know, hard subject for me because, you know, coming from Somalia in the civil war and then moving to Kenya, living there for, you know, a few years in the camp, and then moving to here, to Rochester, and making Rochester home, you know, being like my first home. And then I lived over River Park Commons, Gateway, Mount Hope, for about 10 years. And basically, I grew up there, you know, since, you know, childhood all the way to adulthood. And I only knew growing up that area, you know. And in 2008, and we were basically gentrified and pushed out. And all the people that lived there from Somalia and different area of the world that moved here as a refugee. And, you know, we had our own, you know, community, and we would help each other. We would, you know, support each other. And now these developers came in and pushed us out, promising us that we would come back. And after it's rebuilt, we would come back and we would have the same community again. And when we got pushed out and all over the place in the city, and we had to start all over again. And when we came back after the place was built, and they said, I'm sorry, you guys don't qualify. There's no 3-4 bedrooms available. They purposely built 2 and 1 bedrooms for the most, you know. Mm-hmm. And also the price, the rent, it was really too much for us to afford. And that's what really hurt me from day one. And I always think about it, you know, as I get older. And that's why I joined, you know, the land trust and other community organizers and advocates in the city of Rochester.
Mohammed, can I ask you, when you think about what you thought you were getting into when the developer told you back in 2008, you know, look, you've got to move out. We're rebuilding here, but you'll be able to come back. You'll be able to come back. Did you trust that? Did you think that you were going to be able
yes.
to come back?
Yeah. Yes, because, you know, I mean, growing up, I was a young guy. I mean, I don't know. I didn't know anything about politics. I didn't know professional liars, you know. And I didn't know all this, the way it works, you know. And growing up, I see, you know, people just say whatever they want to say. They can lie about the situation. They don't care about your life. Or they don't care about your safety. They don't care, you know, if you sleep safely at night or whatever it is. They only care about their income, you know. How can we make this place better? How can we bring rich people here? And how can we raise taxes so we can have more money for the city, you know?
I have to admit, and I want to turn to Ryan Acuff for this, because I'm thinking of conversations in the recent months here. And I want to be careful, because I'm going to draw a comparison that I think, I don't know if it's fair, and I want to say that we haven't seen how everything's going to play out at Cornhill, for example. And you've got developers there saying, look, you've got the story wrong. We're very much interested in making sure the people who currently live here are protected. It's not going to be a case of just kind of jacking up rents and et cetera, that this redesign is good for everybody. It's good for access. And it's not just going to be higher rents. We're not going to push people out. And, you know, certainly everybody wants to believe that. I understand that. But I also know that some people who live, for example, there don't trust it. Is Mohammed's story a red flag to you for when promises are made to people, especially people who have lower incomes?
It's definitely a red flag. And basically, you know, what happens is not based on one person or one landlord. There's a whole system in place which prioritizes the wealthy over the working class and the poor. There's a whole system of land and housing which is based in white supremacy from the founding of the country to today, which prioritizes white people having more access to resources and land and housing able to make. Now, so there's a whole system in place. So there's a whole sets of policies in the way that urban planning is done, and the way, like Mohammed's talking about, the taxes are done, and the way people are given subsidies to build, like the projects that he's talking about are all subsidized. These are all planned. It wasn't just, you know, years of planning went into these things, from assistance from the state, from the federal government, to the city, to the developers. There's a whole system. Massive cooperation comes together, people, in order to displace the people that have less income. And the only way to prevent it is to have very specific policies, not promises, but policies that protect long-term residents. You know, and that's why we've been coming together as a community with very specific goals, very specific asks around the community land trusts and other policies that protect long-term tenants, so we can actually build into the structure of the city. Right, the right that the idea that everybody has the right to the city, everybody has the right to remain, whatever neighborhood it is, whether it's downtown, Cornhill, Plymouth Exchange, but everybody should have the right to remain in their own neighborhood. And we're better off. It shouldn't be one neighborhood is just of rich people or white people, but you know, the city thrives from its diversity and being able to. I mean, I think that's what makes the city great, but not just trying to push everybody out of one area.
All right, so I see the phone ringing, and listeners, again, if you want to join the conversation and weigh in on whether you've got questions about how gentrification plays out in practice in real life. If you want to share your own stories, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. The Gentrification Conference is coming your way Saturday, October 20th at the Ryan Community Center on Webster Avenue, 10 to 4 that day. It's 540-540-GentrificationRock.org for more information online. Let me grab our first phone call. It's Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing,
good.
Evan?
Yeah, very good.
Hey,
go
Kevin,
ahead.
How you doing?
Hi, Rich.
Do you guys know each other? What am I missing here?
Yes,
yeah,
Rich,
we know each other.
He's a very prominent guest at a lot of 540 classes and events.
Okay. I've never met. I don't know if I've met you in person, Rich. I hear your voice all the time, but go ahead.
Yeah, we haven't met yet. We will.
Okay.
But the insidious thing I'm noticing about this gentrification is not only happening on the level of the rent or the homes, but you're not seeing affordable housing being built. You're watching the streets change where they're taking away on-street parking, moving people into garages. Even in your school, you look at East High. East High's population has been more than half. And the reason they did it was they got rid of the students they did not want there. Yeah, East High is doing better now. But now there's only 600 students there. So I asked a teacher because the teacher was telling me how great it is now. I said, so what happened to those other 800 students? Where did you dump them? And he was very cavalier about it. He's like, I don't have to deal with them anymore. So this gentrification is not only about rent. It is about an entire remake of this city and cities all around the country to make it more, you know, just make it nicer for the wealthier, the mainstream, the white person who wants to come into the city. And just it's developers constantly maximizing their profits, regardless of what you tell them, what they tell you. And they tell you the streets look nicer. But meanwhile, I've seen 5 parking spots on one street gone because they've made these curves. And then you look at the garages. So it's what I'm seeing is just it's scary to me.
Rich, thank you. And before I kick it over to Calvin and the panel for that, what I want to do is kind of piggyback on the point Rich is making with a question for you guys, because I think Rich is raising another concern about developers. Mm-hmm. And what I want to ask is, building on Rich's concern, he sees it as a concern that primarily is with developers, not really interested in the social impact. And I understand that concern. What I want to ask is it also individuals, and can it be individuals who may have good intentions, not realizing, you know, hey, I want to, there's a property I can afford. There's a property that may be slightly run down. It's not inhabited. I can pick it up for a pretty good price. I can fix it up. I can live there. I can feel really good about that. I want, you know, to be there. It's a cool space. It's a cool area. That's very different than what Rich is raising.
Right.
And I want to ask all of you how you could sort of view those.
Well, I don't want listeners to listen to this conversation and think that the idea behind at least the work that happens at 540 around gentrification is to make it sound like development is not a good thing or that a city doesn't need development. But just from an educational standpoint, at least for me, it's always important for people to understand all of the factors involved. So at an individual level or even at a systemic level, It's great to want to move into a neighborhood and have a mission to improve it. But I think that it's also important for everyone to understand, just to be aware of when, even if you move into an area and you've come from somewhere else to Rochester, just, you know, how are you interacting with your neighbors? Or if there are certain types of, maybe you want to throw a block party, Or how are you looking at your role in that? Sometimes there can be this savior mentality, like I'm going to come in and help this neighborhood be better because the community needs me or needs my organization. And so being aware of the aware of that and how you interact with the neighborhood in general, I think is part of the education of this conference and our work as well.
Let me turn to Jody Francis, who's a member of the Rochester Tenant Union. How do you view this question on what gentrification is? Developers, individuals?
Well, first, I'd like to say thank you, Mr. Dawson, for having us.
Mr. Dawson's
program.
My dad, but that's very kind. Nice having you.
Great. Well, gentrification is not a new word. It's been around for a while. I'm from New York City. I was born in Brooklyn, lived in the Bronx, Nassau County, and Suffolk County, so I've seen it. And the way we go about handling situations like that, usually tenants come together, try to form around unification, around maybe a co-opt, around having rights to be able to. A lot of people have been in places for 10, 15 years, like in my building, and they just give us 60 days notice with no reason and they just say, well, you know, you guys have to move. And so like I said, this is not a new issue. I don't know how, I've been in Rochester for 5 years. I've been studying a little bit about the Rochester's history. And to me, it seems like, we need more help for low-income people and poor people in Rochester. And it seems like there's a push to come into low-income neighborhoods, like this individual said earlier, and clean it up or renovate it. But the people that's been there for years and decades, they're not a part of that plan. And
can I just chime in as well to Jody and Evan? So it's also important for us to remember as well that these are very complex. So we're kind of simplifying the concept a little bit to talk about it here on radio, but this concept of gentrification, history, urban planning, racism, classism, it's very complex. So when you start to unpack it, you begin to see the nuance and complexities of it, of how do developers or people who have good intentions come into an area, maybe with a mission to make it better for everyone, but also be sensitive to individuals who have lived there for decades. It's not black and white. It's not so concrete as sometimes we are making it when we're trying to discuss it and dissect it. It's very complex.
Okay. Ryan, how do you view the difference between developers and individuals?
Yeah, I mean, I think, the key is, like Kevin was saying, is to have a clear vision of development without displacement. So I think the developers can be a part of the solution or they can be a part of the problem. So like in Jody's case, you know, the developer came in. They bought the building on August 24th. This is on Miggs and Monroe. And they just said everybody has to be gone on October 31st. So they're just saying, you know, they didn't call a meeting with any of the tenants. They don't know them. They don't know their stories. They don't know the people. They don't know their history. So there's a tenant's been there for 19 years. Many people don't even live in a home for that long. And because of the so few rights that we have and how skewed the system is, it's completely legal to just kick everybody out. No fault evictions. We saw it at the Cadillac. The developer came in, kicked everybody out, still vacant, right? And instead of renovating, putting money in to benefit the tenants, they're just saying, I'm going to kick it out, get a fresh start. I'm going to bring in a new type of people.
And so, Ryan, just to be clear, these individuals who lived in Meg's and Alexander, for instance, one example, they were paying rent. They were rent paying tenants.
They're not even alleging tenants aren't paying rent, they're causing issues. They're straight up no fault eviction. Some people don't even believe that that's possible. How could you live in a place for 19 years, not cause any trouble, and be evicted in 30 or 60 days? But that's the current state of our law, and that's why we're calling for a fundamental change of statewide policies that protect tenants. So to end no fault evictions, you have to have a reason to evict somebody, and rent stabilization that would end these major buyouts. Instead, through the land trust, we want to support resident control and permanent affordability in all neighborhoods. So what Jody's talking about, where in his building, well, they would have the option to buy their own building and turn it into a cooperative for people that have been living there. Just like we're working with the tenants on Thurston Road, for maybe for them to turn their building into a cooperative, to go from a disaster of an absentee slumlord to resident control and permanent affordability. And this can be done with single family homes, but also apartment buildings. And these are the resident-led solutions, because a lot of people, there's this narrative that people can't make decisions for themselves. So we need an outsider to come in and solve the issues. And if people have money, resources, and power and connections, we want people to come in only to benefit, listening to the residents. This is what we need for our neighborhood, not someone that has some other plan that excludes people, because people have the answers.
Mohammed, can I ask you, 10 years ago when you felt forced out, was there any sort of recourse? Was there any response that you felt was within reach 10 years ago? Could you organize? Was there?
No.
There was nothing?
I couldn't. As I said before, I mean, I had no idea how to organize, how to come together. I was a young man going to college and didn't really understand much. But I did witness a few, tenants that lived in the building for like 20, 30 years, and they were yelling. And when we had meetings, I didn't understand why they were yelling, and they were, saying, this is not right, we need our rights, this and that. And they, one thing that I recall now, they waited, one individual that lived there for a long time, they waited until that individual died, And when that person died and they came days later and said, oh, now we can push everybody out because this individual is not yelling anymore. And that was kind of surprising, and that's something that stayed in me until now, And I started connecting the dots years later,
Evan, I actually have a question for Mohammed, if I can just.
Yeah.
Because this, the develop or the area of where, what is it, Gateway Park, Genesee Gateway Park, I just remember growing up in Rochester and knowing that community to be a Somali community,
yes,
refugee community. Where did a lot of the individuals, because I was at least told or assumed that individuals were put into, maybe they were able to buy homes.
Yeah.
Some individuals who lived in that community, what do you know?
Yes.
Where?
Yeah, I know where they went, and I went where they went to.
Okay.
So, for example, a lot of them, some of them, they were able to secure a house. They took a mortgage. That was not a lot, but for most of us who cannot buy a house, they put us over a vanaker,
vanaker
townhomes, mm-hmm, and the high rise there, and everybody they were put in that place, but that place was not even a safe place, and it was like going back to the war zone again. Because I remember when we moved in to Gateway River Park Commons back in the days, it was a war zone. Even, the police or anybody would not come into the neighborhood and help us out because they were scared. It was, really dangerous place to come to. After a while, we took things in our own hands. We're the one that cleaned up the place. Through our youth and our people who were living there and securing and helping each other to make sure the place is really safe, even to be outside midnight or 2 a.m., we were able to sit outside. Before, we couldn't even sit outside during the day because we would be scared someone would shoot us,
Yeah, so, Evan, I just want to just chime in really quick. So in hearing Mohammed's story, one of the things that when we talk about gentrification and revitalization, Genesee Gateway was a community for many decades. And so
it was
cultural competence and those types of thoughts. If the developers or individuals, maybe with good intentions, we hope, are not thinking about when you displace an entire community of individuals who have come from countries where perhaps community looks very different from how we think about it in the United States or even in Rochester, and you don't engage with those neighbors in a way that's beneficial for them, even if you say, well, people were able to buy homes somewhere else, but you've broken up their community and what they know. And so that's why it's so important to be able to engage with individuals as opposed to this top-down approach.
Yeah, I mean, the community that lived to, that moved to Vanaker, I couldn't live there anymore. I had to move out, mm-hmm, and a year later to a Maplewood area, and then I was able to buy a house 5 years later, and that's where I stay right now. But still, it's a long way from, you know, the way we used to have, because Van Acker is just a different culture. The way it's set up is different, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, I kind of felt like, you know, when we were displaced, I felt like I was moving from another war zone to another safe place again, like how the sense that I was thinking the way I told you before, like moving from a war zone in Somalia and then moving to Kenya and then moving to Kenya saying, hey, now we got to find a new home. New home was Rochester, and then we were settled. You know, we were mm-hmm. Living one place. We thought it was permanent. And then when we started moving out, it was like, oh, it brought like memories again, you know?
Dramatic memories again.
Yeah, dramatic yeah. memories. And now we're being pushed out. This time was not through guns and bombs. It was, mm-hmm. you know, being pushed out in a different way, you know, saying, hey, now you guys have to find a new home. I mean, you know, the other, you know, question I have, if this money that was built, it was a public money through city and the county and the states and federal level, why they didn't allow the, you know, people who moved out of there from the beginning to come back and build a similar housing for them instead of flipping the place with public money and bringing rich multi, million dollars a project back to the rich people. And then if you go there, it's always people with money. And then they use the public money. This is not making sense to me, you know?
Well, let me just say that we have a number of phone calls, emails from listeners who I think are trying to understand the position of our guests more, or have some pushing back a little bit. This will be instructive. So let's go ahead and explore some of these. This is Michael in Penfield. First up, go ahead, Michael.
Hi, Evan, and thanks for having the program. I just want to remind the gentleman on your panel of the basic notion of private property, and many of the buildings that they've spoken of are privately held. People do have a right to do as they wish within the law with their property as they wish. And that's simply a fact. And they need to understand that.
Stay there for a sec, Michael. I appreciate the phone call. Ryan Acuff, you want to start? Calvin? Go ahead.
Sure. I think some people are just really unaware of the laws of the United States, you know, and that that properties are regulated. There are code violations. There's health and safety regulations. Private property is used once in the U.S. Constitution, only to say that it can be taken away with fair compensation. So I think there's a myth around private property that people can just do whatever they want. So
hold on though, Michael, because I certainly want to give you some room to explore this. But go ahead, Ryan.
So I just want to say, so I think the policies we're advocating for, good cause eviction protections, is something that New Jersey's had since 1975. That's also in the United States. We're talking about expanding the laws around rent stabilization to everybody in New York State that exists, just like exists downstate. That's also in the United States, New York City and Westchester County and Nassau County. So everything we're talking about is United States, and we're just talking about fair policies that can benefit everybody in their community. So we believe it's possible to have development without displacement. That's all.
So you want to advocate for those things, and it is within your right to do so, but private property is held by individuals, and they have a right to do with it what they wish, as I said, within the law. And if you want to advocate for changing laws, I think that you should do so. But also bear in mind that people buy property with their money and loans and et cetera, that everything that goes with it, and they do have a right to do with it as they please within the bounds of the law. And so advocate as you will, but understand that that's the case.
Thank you. And I just want to give an example. So so the tenants over at Miggs and Monroe, right, they are getting a legal process to evict them. So today they called an event at 2 o'clock. And after this show, they're going to be delivering a letter to the office of the landlord. The landlord responded, and they said they do want to meet with the tenants, and they do want to work something out. So just because something currently exists in the law doesn't mean that we can't have ethical and moral clarity to secure the housing for everybody. So this is why we work together. As this landlord says, well, you know, actually, I do want to talk to the tenants, when initially they didn't.
Well, that's up to that landlord. If he can do as he pleases. Again, he could have said no. In this case, he has agreed to meet with the residents. It doesn't mean it is still his right to decide in the end whether or not he wishes to comply with your request.
Yeah, I mean, some people hold the law, some people hold property individually, some people hold it collectively. I mean, there's different ways to do it, but thank you for your position. I think what we're trying to do is to have policies that benefit everybody.
Yeah, so when Michael, and Michael, first of all, I mean, I don't think anybody disputes Michael's contention that people who hold private property within the law can do as they please with it. Right. I think there's a couple of questions. One, what is moral and ethical? And then another, what laws ought to change?
Exactly.
And so I think some of what I've heard from groups like Community Land Trust and others over the years is, should there be considerations? If someone has been a tenant for 19 years, as you say, as one example, and they have been rent paying and they haven't caused any issues, should they be given at least more time than, hey, you've got 30 days, you're out of here? Is there an obligation? Is that part of this conversation?
Absolutely. And what's benefits neighborhoods and what's benefits tenants? And I mean, it's, you know, this idea that, well, we all just do individually what we want to do, and whether people are homeless, whether people on the street, people are being displaced, we're fine. And I think a lot of us, there might be some people who just say, I'm just concerned about myself, just my family. But a lot of us want to see our whole community thrive because we're all interdependent.
And if I can add, Evan, I think just from an educational standpoint, which I'll always keep that lens, when we look at history and the laws of the United States, oftentimes the laws were racist and discriminatory of marginalized individuals. So groups like Brian Acuff's, the Tenants Union, and Community Land Trust are saying some of these laws are still discriminating disproportionately individuals who are Black and brown and minorities and homeless or poor. And so if you're looking at it just from that legal standpoint, then there's still issues with the laws.
Yeah, I'm hearing from some listeners saying laws enforcing morality, my goodness. But, well, yesterday on this program, we had, and again, I'm not taking a position for any law. I'm simply facilitating a discussion that points out that yesterday we had a conversation about the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. And in the 1980s and up until 1990 when it was signed, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, and until the very end, the Chamber of Commerce were saying, this is terrible, the ADA is terrible, it will hurt businesses, it's not a good idea, don't do it. Now everybody looks back, just about everybody, and says, well, yeah, the American with Disabilities Act totally makes sense. I can't believe anybody opposed it. In the same way that people used to oppose all kinds of things that the law was required to at least intersecting. But always the question is, where's the line? How much do you allow sort of the free market of human interaction to figure out morality and ethical behavior, and how much do you use the law as a tool? But for those who are like wringing their hands about morality and law, well, that's been happening forever. Go ahead, Jerry.
Well, I'd like to chime in, and I'll say, well, how would you feel if it happened to you? How would you feel if the shoe was on the other foot? And in affluent neighborhoods like Penfield, Brighton, and other neighborhoods, when a business wants to come into the neighborhood and set up shop, those communities have people to speak for them, and they have to go to city council. They have to push the issue. And a lot of those affluent neighborhoods, they form organizations, and they have to see those and deal with those people in that community before they can put a Whole Foods, for instance, or a garage, or change the complexion of the neighborhood. So why is that different for people who are renting? And you want to come in and, you know, a private owner and buy a building. Why don't you contact the tenants how a Whole Foods would do in an affluent neighborhood and want to put in a business, and they have to reach out to the community of private owners? And before they can do that, they have to make legislation. They have to actually have council meetings before they can do this. And it takes 2 to 3 years, sometimes maybe even longer. But they have money, they have lawyers, and they push these things through.
Yeah, money is power.
Exactly. So what I'm saying is, for the speaker from Penfield, why is it that you know affluent neighborhoods, when before a business can come in, you know, they argue, they scream, oh, we don't want our community being this and doing that. Why is it different for renters in neighborhoods that are low income, and private businesses want to come in, or developers, and buy a building, and then why don't they meet with the tenants like they would with communities that are affluent?
All right, I'm shocked to see it's 12:46. I am way late for our only break. If you're on the phone, I've got a ton of feedback here, and I'm going to try to cycle through as much as we can. But I will tell you now, if you can't get through, or if there's more you want to talk about, the Gentrification Conference from 540 West Main is coming up on Saturday, October 20th. They'd love to see you there from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and that's at the Ryan Community Center on Webster Avenue. More information online, 540, that's the numbers, 540 Gentrification Rock. .org. We're right back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, Rochester gets ready to celebrate its inaugural version of Indigenous Peoples Day. That doesn't mean Columbus Day is going away. Monday will be both in Rochester. The city says for the Italian American community, Columbus Day remains important and will be honored. But so will Indigenous Peoples Day, putting Rochester on a growing list of American cities doing this. And we're going to talk about the change and why next hour. Welcome back to Connections. If I come to you on the phone, we got to keep it as tight as we can. But I haven't heard from Jane in so long. Jane, it's so nice to have you back on the phone. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Thank you for that. I just wanted to say, since I live in subsidized housing, I'm aware of the grants that this housing gets, and the subsidies, and even to construct the buildings, they've got money for that. So when he says eminent domain and it belongs to us, I always understood it belongs to you, but you are obligated morally to certain things. And the goal is to prevent homelessness and to provide safe and healthy housing for people, and to just jerk that out from under people who've lived here. I don't care how long they live, but my point is they have gotten taxpayer dollars to construct and maintain these buildings, so it obligates them in a moral sense to return a good to the community and not a destructiveness to the citizens. And you wanted to keep it tight, so I'll leave it there, okay?
Jane, right. Please call more often. It's nice to hear from you.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to hear.
Muhammad's jumping in with that. Others want to add to what you heard from Jane there? Calvin, you're just going to say cosign?
I cosign with Jane. Okay. Sure.
Jane, thank you. I always appreciate your voice. And we were just talking about, where has Jane been? So it's nice to hear you're doing well, at least as well as you can. Let me read a quick email from Timothy, who says, Evan, can the educator on your panel please educate me as a white man? When am I allowed and where am I allowed to buy a house in the city of Rochester? Seems a little snarky, but that's from Timothy. Calvin?
I mean, I think that anyone can buy a property anywhere they're able to buy a property. That's fine. I think that part of just the learning in terms of gentrification is just being aware of a neighborhood and its history, and understanding that your home or property or where you live, we don't exist in bubbles. We exist in a larger context of society, and understand space and place, and even the conversation about being a business owner and having the right to do certain things. But if you're a business owner in downtown Rochester, for instance, and are saying that your establishment is for all people, then you should have laws and policies that reflect those ideals. So I don't think it's saying that people can't buy property or go into a neighborhood, but just understanding the nuance of your neighborhood, and understanding that your presence exists in context with historical factors and many other things, and also that your presence might change the landscape, and being aware of that and understand that, and not thinking that. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Ryan, you want to add to that? Because Timothy's saying, look, as a white man, just tell me where I'm allowed to go.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's that simple. But for me, so like I'm not someone who's in the position to buy a house, but if I were to buy a house, I would buy a house through the community land trust. And the reason is because I wouldn't want my presence to have unintended consequences in our neighborhood. So the idea with buying a house through the community land trust would be, basically, if I buy it, I would sell it for what I got it for and for what I put into it. So it wouldn't be based on speculation, unintended consequences of driving up property values, pushing out long-term residents. So it's more, I would be mindful and being connected with whatever community that I would move into and being part of the community, not separate from it, and being part of the solution and advocating for the benefit of long-term residents. I think that's more as opposed to, well, this neighborhood versus that neighborhood. But what is, I think people should more look at what is your intention and what is your impact and being a part of the residents and what the residents actually want in the neighborhood and being a part of that.
Do you want to be part of the neighborhood in as healthy a way as possible, mm-hmm. or do you want to fundamentally change it, I guess?
Yeah, and I believe Connections had a show about neighborhood and being neighbors and just the context of how we see each other living next to each other, and I think that all is part of the conversation as well.
All right, Bonnie in Rochester next. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. I think one of the things that's significant, a lot of things that are important have already been said, but, you know, in the last 20, 25 years or so, it was decline of cities due to a number of factors. You know, what you see is the people in power tend to want to redo those cities and the models in many of the ways that they were funded before, which was the people have the most money, get, you know, make investments, and then they develop residential alternatives that are high cost. That's what's happened in Rochester downtown, and almost across all of those buildings that they've redone in the last 10, 15 years. So that means you depend on a lot of private money. And the problem is there's been less and less, one of the problems has been, there's been less and less public money put in. Some of the things you're talking about would be enhanced by public money in together with the issues of people from neighborhoods joining together as you were just discussing. That piece is critical to avoid the urban renewal mess of the, you know, of the 60s. So we need the public money and we need these processes. And I also want to say, I wish there would be some programs. Some of the neighborhoods that are low-income neighborhoods have organized more in the last few years. And when you hear them talk, the people who've lived here for years or live in these areas for years, like Clinton Avenue, people, Hispanic culture, have talked about, you know, the things they used to have there and the kinds of things they did, which are not well-known by the community at large. And I think it would be great to have some of that so people understand a sense of community, which can be done in these other methods, is so, so important to the health of the whole area.
It's really beautiful, you know. I really like that idea, and that's the idea we had when we came to Rochester. We created a sense of community. We created home. We created a belonging, a sense of belonging. We belong here, and we had all these people around us that they're from where we're from, and at the same time, you know, understanding the culture in this country, learning the language, the food, the environment, and all the stuff was really coming out nicely. And then when people are displaced and put somewhere that they don't know their neighbor, and then they never met, and they kind of get scared, and it's shocking for them. And a lot of families that I spoke to when they were brought here and put in the middle of a neighborhood that they don't even know around them, and they don't know their neighbors. They sometimes they don't even eat days because they don't even know where to go. Where's the grocery store around them? And when they call, you know, the Catholic Family Center and say, "Hey, I need help," you know, it takes time to send somebody there and to help them and show them places. And again, it's a language barrier. But when you have a community living next to each other, and I've been here 10 years ago, and then somebody new comes in and say, "Hey, you know, I know where the hospital is. I know where the supermarkets are. We will help you. Don't worry. You know, we know what you like, you know, what kind of food you eat and all that." And it's easier on the people when they come here. But when you're just put in somewhere that you don't know, it's kind of very, you know, scary.
All right, so last 30 seconds, I want to kick it over to Jody Francis, because I heard, Jody, from some listeners who say the compelling personal stories from your panelists are strong, but are we going to discourage actual investment, actual development? And I'm hearing from everyone on the panel that that's not the goal here.
No, we support plans to renovate our building, you know, but we, the tenants, should be the ones to benefit from those renovations. We have tenants that's been in our building for over 19 years. So they immersed in the community. We have residents who are on disability, and they're of age. Where
so you can develop and include people who have been longtime residents.
I mean, I believe that's the moral thing to do.
You know. All right, so if you want to continue this discussion, and boy, Calvin, we could have gone all day, it turns out.
For sure.
Well, they are going to go all day from 10 to 4 anyway on Saturday, October 20th, 540gentrificationrock.org. Thanks to all of the organizers, and thank you to Calvin, Jody, thank you, Muhammad, Ryan, thank you very much for being here this hour.
Thank you.
Appreciate the conversation. Thank you for having us today. Listeners, want to just tell you real quick that this coming Tuesday, Connections is here at WXXI, but it's downstairs. It's a live studio audience, and if you want to be part of it, we're talking about the opioid epidemic on multiple fronts. You're going to hear stories of recovery, one of the most remarkable personal stories. A guy named Brandon Scott, you really want to meet him. You can be here. Please be here for that next Tuesday, noon to 2. More details on that next hour or on WXXI.org.